all of us, we're going to have to change the way we think. Nonprofit organizations, especially in LA, are really starting to stop working in silos and work together, not just in coalition, but also in alliances. Also understanding what roles we play. Some of us are ground game movement builders. Some of us are able to do the lobbying and the pushing in the state houses or in the county offices, in our local city offices. Some of us have the ability to do both, but we need to all be having the same conversation so we can move the needle towards justice and liberation, which is what we're all here to do in the first place.
Justice takes many forms and many hands. I'm Shane Murphy Goldsmith, President and CEO of Liberty Hill Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to Season 2 of Conversations from the Front Lines, where we tackle some of the most challenging social justice issues of the day with heart and honesty. This season, we're focusing on the topic of power, politics, and solidarity in LA. We've gathered some of LA's frontline political and community leaders to go behind the scenes of the fights for social change, the efforts to build community power, and the work to increase solidarity across movements. Get ready for some frank conversations and real talk on Conversations from the Front Lines. Today, I'm joined by Derek Steele, Executive Director of Social Justice Learning Institute. Hi, Derek. How are you?
Fantastic. How you doing, Shane?
I'm pretty good. So good to see you and hear your voice.
Oh, man, it's good to be seen and good to be heard.
Wonderful. Well, welcome to our podcast. It's such a joy to be with Derek Steele, who is the Executive Director of Social Justice Learning Institute. Why don't we start by Derek telling us what's got you fired up these days?
Man, there's a lot to be fired up about, but I think what's at the top of mind, I have the pleasure of serving as the chair of the Care First Community Investment Advisory Committee in LA County. That work is what used to be Measure J, and we all know the Measure J is still up for appeal. In fact, there is a date for the appeal coming up next week.
And can you remind our listeners, what is Measure J?
So Measure J was a fantastic measure that was put forth by the community to make sure that there was direct community investment and also alternatives to incarceration resources by way of 10% of the county's unrestricted budget being able to go towards these things, right? And so it was passed by a wide margin. Very, very successful. This happened during the summer of equity, as I like to call it, as we brought forth a lot of change post George Floyd, post Dejon Kizzee, post Brian Tillman being killed by the police. At the same time, COVID was really changing all of our lives. And we got together as movement builders and as community members seeking change that we wanted to see. And so Measure J was part of that change and ushering in. And I think we'll talk about a little bit more of all the other things that happened during that time too. But Measure J was ushered in, and the work of allocating resources towards community programs, different organizations, like, it's been very, very successful over the years. Year one dollars have hit the ground the most. Year two is actually rolling out now. But this year we had the opportunity to start to allocate year three dollars. And I'm just really fired up about where we are with that process, because over time, it's gotten even more robust when it comes to community engagement and how we lead with community voice with a process that is really very wonky when it comes to the way county does business. So the equity in county contracting and the work that's coming out of that has a role to play in this. And we're seeing the transformation of the county by way of just this simple $100 million that happens every year. And there's more to come. We're pushing for more resources to go in that direction. So yeah, as you can see, I can talk on and on and on if you let me. It's a really good space. What makes CFCI unique is that it's not just community voice. We have department heads that are in the grouping of 24 advisory committee members who are representing different populations of our community by way of the Black community and the Native American, Alaska Native community, representing Reimagine Los Angeles folks, the faith community, LGBTQI+, like everybody is in this space having a conversation about how we should steward these resources, shaping money that is brought forth by the public. We're having dynamic conversations that I don't think any other commission really has the ability to do because of the people who are in the space.
Yes.
Really cool.
Yes. Well, let's talk a little bit more about this. Measure J is definitely one of my favorite things that I've ever gotten to be involved in at Liberty Hill. And the campaign to win Measure J, I think Liberty Hill was the biggest foundation contributor, and a lot of our donors gave. So thank you if you're listening. So many of our community partners fought so hard for it. And it was such a crazy time because it was, you know, I think the analysis of the time was like with the Black Lives Matter movement, all of the upheaval and solidarity that came about after George Floyd was murdered. Measure J was really the big thing that came out of it. I think nationwide, it was sort of the most clear thing we could see across the country that it was a response to that moment that really got to the heart of the idea of reinvesting money out of a punishment system and into a care first system. So that's where the name comes from, Care First Community Initiative. One question I have for you about that is I remember at the time we were reflecting on, there was a defund / abolition kind of language that was creating so much momentum and passion among folks on the ground, and also turning some folks away who apparently were saying, I support the cause, but I don't like the messaging or the framing. And Measure J kind of did a really interesting thing where it was clearly rooted in a defund philosophy, meaning moving money out of a bad thing and into a good thing, but didn't really lead with that frame because they wanted a big voter margin, which is what they got. So just curious your reflections on that kind of context.
I think it's an ongoing context and conversation that is happening amongst us as movement builders, right? Especially those who fundamentally believe in the care first, jails last, if not jails not even present, philosophy of life, right? Incarceration does not make things better at all. But the dialogue that we continue to have is about how we get to that type of future. There are those of us that are just like, it doesn't matter what it looks like when we rip the Band-Aid off. We just need to rip the Band-Aid off and just eliminate it all. And let's figure out what the future looks like. There are those of us who are a little bit more pragmatic. We had a chance to sit down together and have a conversation about how we move forward. And though the movement towards defunding the police and moving away from the carceral state still are part of the fabric and the foundation of all the movement bills happening, from not even just from Measure J, but you talk about the Black Student Achievement Plan that LAUSD is doing. That all started and stemmed from the movement of young folk talking about the elimination of police on school campuses. So it's always part of the foundation. And I think even in the language of defunding the police, that was always a part of the narrative. We're not just saying defund for the sake of defunding. It is use those resources to spaces that are actually going to do more care for the community and repair the harm that has been done because of the way we've done things in the status quo. Measure J is an example. BSAP is an example of the application of the tenets of defunding the police. At SLI, we like to say eliminate the carceral state and police, but replace it. You know, so it's really, let's have that conversation about what we're replacing it with. We have a responsibility, I think, of bringing that narrative to the forefront. Folks on my team like Gary Hardy, who's our policy and advocacy director, he is also a school board member at Linwood School District. And so they have already done the work to eliminate police off their campuses. And we have an ability to talk about and look at the data and the outcomes that have come from that actually happening on that school campus and bringing it to other school districts in a conversation about how we can actually extrapolate that across the entire county, right? So there is real work that's happening behind this thing. And I think, again, it starts with what the youth had to say, what the community had to say about going in a different direction than the status quo.
Love it. There's so much more to say about all of that. But before we get too far along, I want to go back a little bit in history to the beginning of Derek Steele. Obviously, you're this extraordinary young, still leader and organizer who has recently taken the helm of SJLI. We would just love to hear about how your upbringing and how you think your upbringing shaped you into the person you are today. And I believe there's a Northrop Grumman chapter of your life, which we must hear about.
I'm going to go even further than that. I'm a preacher's kid, right? And so service was always a part of the fabric of who I am as an individual. Being able to have service to my church congregation or even to the greater community in which the church actually existed in, traveling with my pops to people's homes, going to the hospitals, but then also with my parents being a part of movement building around anti-gang violence and how we can heal our community from that standpoint with the movements that were happening there in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, because that's where I'm from. There was also campaigns. Like my parents were a part of different campaigns. So like I've gotten to see that firsthand of like what a lot of these different aspects look like when you're trying to create change on behalf of your people. Then you fast forward, I went to Morgan State University in Baltimore, Maryland for electrical and computer engineering. And one of the very first actions that I was a part of was going up to the state capitol to advocate for more dollars. Morgan is a HBCU. And we were finding that resources were going to all the other Maryland schools, University of Maryland, the Baltimore system, the community college, like all the money was going to the PWIs, but there wasn't resources that were coming to the HBCUs. And so we went to go advocate on behalf of our library to make sure that there was dollars going towards that project that we had tried to put forth, but they had actually decided not to fund. When you look at the Morgan magazine for that year, on the front cover of that protest, I'm standing in the front with my Gap bag. You know what I mean? So the movement building has always been a part of like who I am. So fast forward a little further. I did a lot of internships while I was in at school, and I got a chance to work at Northrop Grumman. And when I applied for the job, they said, we got good news and bad news. And what's the good news? Good news, you got the job. It's like, great. The bad news is it's all the way in Los Angeles. I said, wait, what part? Like, you're saying Los Angeles, California, right? So yeah, it's not bad news, especially if you're going to pay me to go here. So that was what it was. So I moved to California, particularly to Inglewood. I've never lived anywhere else except for Inglewood, California, since I moved out here in 2008. The city embraced me, and I have done my due diligence to give back to the city as well. I did Northrop Grumman for about 3 years, and I hated it. There's a whole story that goes along with that, but I won't get into it. But it afforded me the opportunity to volunteer at the Social Justice Learning Institute. And it was because I got diagnosed with hypertension at the age of 25. And my wife now, who was my girlfriend at the time, we would walk the community because we didn't have a car at the time, and we'd have to go to the grocery store. The produce wasn't good, so we'd have to take 2 buses to get to the nearest Whole Foods in El Segundo. And using all of the EBT money that we had at the time to try to do that. And in the process of doing that for about 6 months, she came up with the idea of just looking at all the vacant land we had. Like, we should be growing food in these spaces. And so that's where 100 Seeds of Change came to life. We wrote the proposal, sent it to the mayor. The mayor introduced her to Dr. Scorza. And Dr. Scorza, who was doing work at Morningside High School at the time with the students, building Inglewood's first ever community garden, loved the idea, and the organization adopted it. And that's how we became volunteers at SJLI.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. And Dr. Scorza is the founder and former executive director of SJLI and also a guest on this podcast. So listeners, feel free to check that out. Lots of synergies here. What an amazing trajectory. But so how did you go from how and why and like, how did it go to go from the engineering Northrop Grumman world to this social justice, social change world?
It's a great question. You know, it starts with knowing that every engineer you ever know is always taught that engineers solve problems, right? That's what I am oriented toward and the way I think about the world. I think about the world from a systems approach. Even when we were doing the food work, starting off as volunteers, but then also becoming a part of the team over time, it was a systems approach to it. Build these gardens so that we can have this network of food that's grown in our community that we can aggregate together and share with each other. Build a CSA, a farmer's market based off of local food that's being grown. Like, it was always a hyper-local focus and a system that we were trying to create. That is my approach to this work. When we're looking at a lot of the issues that are coming up in our communities, it's not the people that are the problem when it comes to these things. It's really the systems that are broken that cause the people who are living within them to have to make decisions that don't make sense, right? So if we solve the systematic problems, then we can really start to really tap into the social conditions that people are living in that can be transformed for them to live whole, free, healthy, thriving lives, right? And so that is my orientation. That is where I kind of come from with this, and that approach and the freedom that SJLI has been able to give to me to be able to lean into a lot of these thinking and also work within them and craft things up to be able to make our programs that much better. I think that's the reason why we've been able to thrive over the last 15 years, you know, and continue to grow.
Yes. And what was the slogan? Whole, free, healthy, thriving lives?
That is correct.
Love it.
The idea is people should be able to live liberated lives. I think we've all seen the baseball analogy of what equity is. Three people, a very short person, a very tall person, and a mid-sized person who are standing behind a fence. The very tall person can see over the fence. The very short person can't see at all. And the very mid-sized person can like peek over the fence. The next picture that we use actually is the reality of the world, where the shortest person actually is underground, right? So he really can't see anything. The tallest person has hella boxes that he's standing on top of. And the person who's in the middle is still kind of stuck in the middle. And the thought is that if you could look at it from an equity approach, not just giving everybody one box so that they can see, because that doesn't solve the problem, but taking a needs-based assessment and giving people what they need, all of them can actually see over the fence in the same way. But we take it a step further, eliminate the fence. Let's liberate everybody from this so that people can live whole, free, thriving, healthy lives.
Oh, I love it. Eliminate the fence. Tell us about Social Justice Learning Institute. What do you all do over there? What are you focused on?
The Social Justice Learning Institute is dedicated to improving the overall health, education, and well-being of youth and communities of color. And we do that by making sure that people have the ability to be empowered to create the change they want to see. And our pillars of which we go about that work starts with research. We want to make sure that people have the knowledge that they need, that they're empowered with the information and the information that they're not just finding from the literature reviews that we may be going through, but also learning how to do the research themselves by way of participatory action research. So that's youth participatory action research in our flagship programs like Urban Scholars, which is a credit-bearing class that students can take where they're learning about themselves as individuals, seeing themselves into the future by way of college or career, but also seeing themselves in community and being change agents in that community, and using YPAR as a tool to be able to be the agents of change in that community by doing the research, knowing what's going on in history from in their communities, but also surveying their community members, coming up with that data, synthesizing it, and then coming up with solutions to the problems that they've identified.
YPAR is Youth Participatory Action Research.
That's right. But there's also community-based action research, where we do that through our health equity work and helping people do landscape analysis around their community and like what does healthy food need to look like, or what does health in the built environment need to look like in order for you to be able to live that healthy life that we were talking about. The research is a very critical part of the conversation because that's where the power comes from. You're talking about power building. If people have the information and they have the knowledge of where everything is and how the structures actually work, then they can do the work to start creating thriving communities by working with each other in order to do those things. And when you have all these thriving communities popping up, that's how you change systems too, because the system as is can exist with thriving communities going in a different direction. The second pillar is training. So we got to show people how to do that. And we do that. So the idea is that you have the knowledge from the research, you have the know-how from the training, and now you have the capacity to be the one who is mobilizing the community, which is the third pillar. So I said a lot. If you don't remember anything else off of what I just said, SJLI builds people. That's what we do.
And so, you know, earlier on, you talked about your role in the Care First Community Investment Advisory Committee. So first of all, it's very funny that you said you're super excited about that, because how often do people say they're excited about any type of committee, especially one that involves interacting with the public? One of the themes of this podcast is about inside-outside strategies. So we're talking to elected officials and organizers like you and, you know, wanting to learn more about the interplay and the strategies for, you know, inside-outside strategies. And you're in this really interesting position because it's not just that you're an organizer on the outside strategically partnering with folks on the inside, but you're kind of also an insider in this advisory role. So I'm curious, you know, how do you think about inside-outside strategies and particularly kind of your role as an insider? What are the challenges and opportunities there?
Well, I'll start with philosophically, SJLI has always saw itself standing at the door, keeping the foot in the door. And the reason why I say that is if we are the tool or the vessel that community members are using in order to be able to have the audience with those in seats of power, someone has to be standing in that gap to be able to make sure that those conversations can take place. Sometimes it's gotten us in a little bit of heat with some of our partners on the ground because we are usually having conversations with our peers inside the system, fellow electeds that believe in philosophically what we believe in, and trying to have those conversations, bridging the gap to be able to continue the dialogue and the conversation. I should say that the inside-outside strategy becomes easier when you have the door open to be able to keep the dialogue going. As a person who is on the Care First Community Investment Advisory Committee, I think we are seeing something that is very, very unique. Something you don't normally see with commissions, something that you don't normally see with these types of bodies. mainly because of the decision makers who's in the space. Many times commissions are made up of just the community members being able to say and give forth what they feel and give their strategies on how whatever commission that they are a part of can be changed and transformed. But this is also moving resources with those who are normally the keepers of those resources at the table as a part of the conversation. So if we're talking about alternatives to incarceration and the Department of Mental Health, as well as the Department of Probation, is at the table as a part of the conversation, it's different than them getting it secondhand and them still doing whatever they want to do, even though the commission has said something else. We're making decisions in ways that can actually change the way these departments do business. If the resources are going to come to those departments and the commission has the oversight or responsibility of those resources, those department heads have to answer to the space. You know what I mean? So it's better for us to go into the conversation on the same page with the way the resources should be stewarded and the way we should be actually taking care of community than it is for you to have to get called to the carpet because you didn't do or steward the resources the way they were supposed to be stewarded. So I feel like there's a value add, and by saying this, that my personal philosophy on this is that the future, especially now that the shared economy has taken hold, AI is on the rise, technology is transforming our lives every single day, it's going to be important, especially now that racial equity is at the center of the conversation and how we make sure we're taking care of people, the people-centered parts of the economy are going to have to start working together. And that's philanthropy, that's government, and that's also nonprofit organizations. Where normally we work in silos, try to find ways to depend on each other. There's really more of a fabric of interdependency that we have to start to develop to be able to be the foundation of the lives of the people we're trying to serve. There's going to need to be a change in approach that each part of this people-centered part of the economy are really going to have to start to look at each other at. I think spaces like CFCI are a beginning of that because nonprofit organizations are in that space. Philanthropy is watching that space and supporting it. And I can give examples of what that looks like, but it's also a government space, you know, so it's pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And can you say more about the type of heat you've gotten from activists or organizers on the outside?
I think that's given it too much energy. There have just been some conversations we've had to have with our peers to explain what we're doing, right? Because from the outside looking in, if you don't have the context, it's like, well, whose side are you on, bro? You know what I mean? That's really the question. And when you answer the question truthfully and say exactly what we're talking about and give the context of the conversations that are happening with community members, with those who may be in decision-making seats, it doesn't necessarily need to be elected officials. It could be anybody. When we are standing in that pathway to be able to keep that dialogue going so that transformative change can take place, then it's understood, right? And I think all of us, again, we're going to have to change the way we think. Nonprofit organizations, especially in LA, are really starting to stop working in silos and work together, not just in coalition, but also in alliances. Also understanding what roles we play. Some of us are ground game movement builders. Some of us are able to do the lobbying and the pushing in the state houses or in the county offices, in our local city offices. Some of us have the ability to do both, but we need to all be having the same conversation so we can move the needle towards justice and liberation, which is what we're all here to do in the first place.
Yes, indeed. And I heard you recently say about the sort of nonprofit industrial complex, you said you can't change the game if you don't know the rules. And that to me shows your strategic and that very sort of engineering systems mindset, which I just think is so interesting. Would love to hear you say more about, you know, the nonprofit industrial complex. It started as a tax, you know, vehicle, and now it's become this whole ecosystem that provides opportunities and limitations to folks wanting to make a difference. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, man, you can't be a scientist of physics and not understand the laws of physics. And if you're one of those type of people trying to make it up along the way as if there isn't something that existed before it, then you're doomed to repeat the same mistakes that have happened before. SLI, when it was first being brought forward in its early days, trying to decide what the name was going to be, there was a very deep dialogue about Sankofa, really being able to look behind to know what was there so that you don't repeat the same things. You can learn from the past and be able to move forward. that's the same idea and philosophy that I have about the work we do on a day-to-day basis. If we are trying to, again, move towards people living whole, free, thriving, liberated lives, the question becomes, what are the things that are standing in the way as barriers? How did those barriers actually come to be? Because they didn't just come out of nowhere. The system of white supremacy as it exists started off as anti-blackness. If you look at the history of this country, it was kind of built on those things. And the systems have been put in place along the way. So I'll give an example. SB 1373 is a bill this year that we're working on that is doing the work to eliminate the mandate for schools to have to report to the police or law enforcement every time that there is an incident on campus. Doesn't matter if it's an argument with willful defiance with a student and a teacher, to something as extreme as like a physical altercation. You know, I can understand if it gets dangerous, then yes, you have to involve law enforcement. But for things that can have restorative justice be used as a tool to solve that issue, you shouldn't be required to have to call law enforcement. Right now, if they don't, schools get fined up to $1,500 per instance that they don't call the police, right? So you see that systemically, that is the school to prison pipeline, because you have to call the police come onto the campus, that student actually gets caught up in a whole situation from a law enforcement standpoint that now puts them in a posture of being system involved. If you don't know the ed code, if you don't know the rules of how things are done status quo, you can't undo the status quo. So I think that's just a small example of a larger picture of like the work we have to do and be analysts and really understand how this system actually flows so that we can actually create better structures to be able to go in a different direction.
Absolutely. And the other thing, you know, when you talked about liberation, you know, that's a big word that we don't want to just say casually. And I'm curious, what do you envision when you think of liberation? Part of the reason I ask is I think, like you said, we've gotten better and better at understanding the world as it is, you know, understanding the how things work and the harmful impacts of the current systems we have. And we know that in order to build something better, we need to envision that. But, you know, it's challenging to envision a society and a way of relating to each other that we've never experienced. And I think liberation certainly, you know, we may have moments of an experience of liberation, but certainly a, you know, this country is, as you said, founded in white supremacy, has been building fences to prevent liberation for our entire history. So we'd just love to hear what does it mean to live a liberated life?
I'll use the analogy that you just said about building a fence. The people who live inside the fence are living very free, whole, thriving, healthy lives, right? And when you think about it that way, it's not something that's foreign, right? It's not something that is non-existent and hard to imagine because it already exists. The question is, how do we eliminate the fences? How do we eliminate the barriers so that all of us have the ability to live life in that fullness? If you're looking at it from that framework, well, what was done to be able to create this space of liberation that already exists? Agitation, right? Be honest, like the folks who live in Santa Monica don't have a lot of the things that they have just by happenstance. If you ever gone to a city council meeting in Santa Monica or a school board meeting in Santa Monica, you can see that the agitators are there to make sure that the things that they want to have in place are there. And they understand the structures. They understand how it works. They understand the pieces that have been put in place and what stuff needs to be undone so that those things and the thriving space that they have in that community can continue to be that. Again, this is not a foreign idea. We just have to make sure that the historic structures that have been put in place, look at it from a housing standpoint, understanding covenants and what role they play and how that had a big deal to be with redlining and how that came to bear. How to undo those things. Those are the fences. Those are the barriers that exist that we don't see, that we don't talk about, that we don't normally hear, that we have to undo to be able to broaden the scope for liberation and access for all people to be able to live thriving lives. If you talk about oil fields, even, you know what I mean? Like, what were the rules that were put in place for people to have that type of ownership of not just land, but also mineral rights and air rights? right? What are air rights and mineral rights all together in the first place? And who came up with those rules? What do we need to do in order to broaden, eliminate the fences around that so that people can all have access to these things too, right? So this is what I mean when I say about the rules of the game. You can't change it without knowing how it's being played. These are the things I'm talking about. But I also say this, Shane, from the way that nonprofit organization exists in our relationship with philanthropy, as well as a relationship with the government, like, you also have to know the rules that govern your entity as well, and what capabilities you have based on the entity you have too. You'll have a lot of folks who will start a nonprofit organization because they have a great idea of how to serve people without really getting the deep dive and understanding of what it means to have a 501c3 organization. And like, even the rules that came to bear to be able to have that type of tax status, and how that can be beneficial to your community beyond just the idea you have. So those are the things that we have to come to the table, be on the same page about, be able to come to a way of working together rather than working in silos to be able to uplift our communities, to be able to eliminate the barriers that I was talking about, to live whole, free, thriving lives for all those people that we serve.
And speaking of eliminating these silos, one of the themes of this podcast is the multiracial solidarity and multiracial democracy. And I had the wonderful privilege of getting to interview Steve Phillips, who wrote the book, How We Win the Civil War, which was an incredible piece on kind of the history of the Confederate battle that he says is rages on today. January 6th was just a public exhibit of it, but it's happening in all sorts of ways. And so we have to sort of know the nature of the fight we're in order to fight it. If we're pretending that we're beyond that, then we're not gonna, or I'm losing the metaphor. I'm not good at war metaphors, but we're not gonna be able to win the battle or win the war.
We're care first, war last. So it's all good.
We need different metaphors.
We gotta worry about it.
But what I want to ask you is, you know, multiracial solidarity and multiracial democracy, I mean, those are big, big concepts. It feels national. It feels like the whole world would have to change to accomplish it. And so I would love to know, from your role at SJLI in Inglewood in Los Angeles, how do you see your work as advancing and helping to build a multiracial democracy and multiracial solidarity?
Man, I will say that it starts with knowledge of self so that you have the ability to share that with others, and coming to these conversations with open hearts and open minds, and orienting ourselves around the same goals and aspirations. When we really start to share like the stories of which our communities come from and the detriments that the system that exists as is has done to put us in the positions that we are, we understand that there's many of the same type of starting places and ending places that we end up in. That means that the process to create the change we want to see can be similar in nature too. It just really comes with us having that dialogue and also doing the needs-based assessment to be able to provide folks what they need. So I'll give you an example. Year 3, CareFirst Community Investment. One of the things that was missing from year 2 was that I think of the representation of the survey that was put out that year, we had maybe 3% of the survey respondents be from the American Indian, Alaska Native, and Indigenous community. And so because of that, the representatives that are a part of the advisory committee this year, as we put together the game plan for community engagement, there was an emphasis on having trusted messengers be a part of our process. And who are the trusted messengers? Nonprofit organizations that are operating in various spaces throughout LA County. We picked 9 that represented the different populations, but also the different areas that we wanted to lift up by way of the Justice Equity Needs Index, as well as the Justice Equity Services Index, using the ARDI tool as well, the Anti-Racism Diversity and Inclusion tool that is there as well. We had UAII, as well as the California Native Vote Project, support the process as trusted messengers, as well as organizations that represented South LA, that represented Antelope Valley, that represented Long Beach, that represented San Gabriel Valley. All these organizations coming together to help get the word out about the community engagement process that we were doing for this year's allocation. So that turned into now 23% of the respondents from the surveys, as well as the community listening sessions that we did, being from the community. You know what I'm saying? There was a more even spread representation.
You mean 23% from the Native Indigenous community?
Exactly, yes.
Up from 3%.
Up from 3%.
Oh, that is incredible. Wow.
And that's because of the work of the Trusted Messengers. But guess who supported the Trusted Messengers?
Who?
It was actually California Endowment. Resources that we got from them helped to pay for the Trusted Messengers to do their work. SLS was the community engagement organization that the county selected, helped to put all the pieces together, like the literature and the outreach tools and all that, as well as the ad hoc committee who was in charge of community engagement from CFCI's advisory committee, working together to come up with this game plan to actually implement it so that the more representation can actually be a part of this conversation and dialogue that we're having in community. That started from a conversation around what the needs really were and being honest about what the downfalls were of the process that we had from the previous time frame. We weren't arguing about it. It was a tough conversation to have because feelings were definitely involved in it, but it wasn't a drop dead like, oh, we're angry at each other, so we're never going to work together. It was, what can we do to solve this problem now that we know what the issue actually is? You see what I'm saying? I use that as an example of how we can do this work in a real way and create solidarity amongst our communities. I feel like it's about interdependency of our communities. That means that we have space to just be us and to do the things and figure out the things we need for our own communities. But being open to and leaving room for interdependency of coming back to the table and making sure that we're taking care of each other in that space too, right? So it's not just about you and yours. It's about all of us while you're also taking care of you and yours.
Oh my gosh. I could spend 7 more hours digging into everything you just said. What I want people to understand who are listening to this is how just groundbreaking everything you're talking about really is. I mean, this is not historically the way that social change organizations have operated. I mean, there's usually this sort of very strict polarization, like you're either doing direct services and or working inside government, or you're on the outside doing organizing. But, you know, this idea that you're standing in the gap, holding, you know, your foot in the door, that you and so many others, you know, that Liberty Hill works with across the county on all sorts of issues are actually getting real power, decision-making power. The county doesn't do anything on youth justice issues without consulting the folks who are working with youth and youth themselves. And that was not happening a few years ago. And there's a million county committees and working groups, and they're filled with our folks. And, you know, on the one hand, there was a sort of moment where I was like, wow, this is real power. Like, even kids who have been, you know, in jail are now on the committee to tell the county how to implement. And, you know, now we're in this sort of evolving stage where the county's relying so heavily on very small, under-resourced community organizations that I'm beginning to wonder, what are we trading to have the seat at the table and real power? You know, are we giving up so much of our capacity to do the work on the ground? And so just so many strategic questions and opportunities that raises. But yeah, go ahead and respond and then we'll wrap up.
Now that everybody is paying attention, the energy that came out of the Summer of Equity really galvanize folks who want to do something quick and also looking for silver bullets. But that's not what this is. Even the way that the Constitution was written, it was written with the First Amendment being that agitators have the ability to exist, which means that forever, we are always going to need folks who are prepared to agitate the system to continue to get towards the larger ideals of all folks being created and being able to exist as equal folks in the society that we have. This idea of a world that can exist in that way is work that we have to do every single day. But we are in an unprecedented time in LA County with all the things that have happened, right? So I mentioned Measure J, but the Anti-Racism, Diversity, and Inclusion Office was designed. And so under Dr. Scores' leadership in that space, the county is changing how they do business. You have the equity in county contracting that is now taking place, and the tenets of that are starting to take hold in different departments. You have the election of Supervisor Holly Mitchell takes place, and her leadership and her way of thinking now being brought to the Board of Supervisors. And also with the leadership that was already there, we have now all women who are leading the county, right? What element that actually brings to the table about how we're thinking about the world. I can go on and on about all the things that kind of got ushered in at that particular time that we are now bearing the fruits of labor. I mean, it's not even only that Mayor Karen Bass was actually elected, but how she was elected and what she was up against because of the movement building that has taken place over time to be able to make something like that take place. We are in unprecedented times. And I believe that the people-centered economy are part of the economy of us working together. We can actually create something stronger if nonprofit organizations continue to build camaraderie with each other and get out of the silos. If philanthropy is starting to orient itself in a posture of putting itself out of business, let's be real. Because if we start talking about how money actually got to philanthropy in the first place and how it moves, that's a whole different conversation. I'm sure you have a podcast with somebody else to talk about that. But being able to orient itself in way, but not just do it a cavalier, but like, how are we stewarding our resources in a way that is going to be very impactful so that forever after we have done our part, things never go back to the way they were. And government has to stop acting like they got all the answers and start listening to what's going on in the community and leading with community voice. And if we can do that and work in partnership with each other, we become the fabric and the new foundation of what the lives of people look like so that they can live those whole, free, thriving lives that I was talking about.
So a couple more things. First is a call to action. What is something that our listeners can do today as individuals to uplift this vision for multiracial solidarity?
As you're listening to everything we talked about just now, what role do you play? What capacity do you feel like you can fill in and you can be a part of, right? Find out what's already happening in that space, listen to what's going on, and then find out how you can enter in and be a part of it. You ain't got the answer, so don't be coming to the table acting like you do. Come and listen first, and then join in to the party, because the party's going on, and it's a lot of fun. I will also state that the life that we are trying to see for people does not take place without people having open hearts and open minds, being ready to listen to each other and care for each other, right? So it's all about the care first society. Care first. Yeah, gels last, but care first. What role do you play in order to bring that and usher that in?
Beautiful. For our fun, real talk question, last question of the day, Derek, finish this sentence. The way to my heart is...
Oh, wow. That automatically takes me to my wife. You say that to my heart, and my heart is with my wife. And so if you're trying to find out how I feel and why I do what I do, watch what she's doing. And she is the one who inspires me to be the great person that I'm trying to be every single day. Her and my girls, right? I'm trying to make the world better for my oldest and youngest daughter. I'm trying to also live up to the expectations that my wife probably doesn't even have of me, but I have in my own head because of how great she is.
That's beautiful. All right. Thank you, Derek. And thank you to everyone who's joining us for our second season of Conversations from the Front Lines. Don't forget to subscribe, leave a comment, and share this podcast with a friend who's interested in learning more about the fight for social justice.
All right.